tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 430 of the Toonami Escape podcast. My name is C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
And Crocodile.
Good evening.
All right. We don't have a whole lot of news this week. The only thing I really had to mention, because we got such big news at the end of our previous podcast, I do want to mention they did do a game review this week, which was for a game called The Midnight Walk. And in a somewhat surprise, they didn't give it an 8.5. They gave it a 9.
Yeah, for Toonami, that's like an 11 out of 10.
Pretty much.
I'm not familiar with this game.
It's kind of neat. It seems to be like a platforming puzzle game with like it was created using like claymation style, and then they transferred the clay models into 3D.
Oh man, that must have been a ton of work.
It looks really cool. And the only other thing I know about it, because I heard about this game, because it's also available. You can play it like on regular consoles, but you can also play it in VR. And I'm actually kind of interested to try the VR version to see what that's like. So,
oh, interesting.
So yeah, 9.0, they really liked it. And they even said that during the review. I thought it was kind of funny. He said, we played the flat version instead of the VR version.
The VR version is the, what's opposite of flat? Like,
well, VR, I guess. I mean, it's funny, in VR circles, one of the terms they often use to describe normal games is they call them pancake.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Does this like a stack?
Just because it's flat.
Yeah.
Like, it's not three-dimensional, or like, it's 3D in like 3D graphics, but it's not 3D, stereoscopic 3D, so.
Right, right. I'm just trying to think if this is colloquially called flat. I'm just trying to figure out what VR games are colloquially called. Like, we wouldn't call them like, I don't know, busty or something. That'd be really weird or something. So I don't know, like, what the word
I don't think there is one. Yeah, I'm a big VR gamer. I just think it's a VR version. That's always what I say, so.
That's fair enough. Well, let us know if you truly tried the VR version. Let us know how you enjoy it.
Oh, yeah. I'm kind of interested to try it. And before we move on from the news, I was curious, Crocodile, what were your thoughts about the big Daima announcement?
Daima? Don't you mean the Ninja
Kamui? Oh, no, not Daima. I'm sorry. The Ninja Kamui announcement.
Yeah, like, I remember a while back, there was, like, I don't know if it was a leak or something, but someone from one of the production companies had posted kind of like, oh, season 2 is in works or something. And I remember you had to walk that back at DeMarco to be like, I don't see nothing, I don't hear nothing or whatnot, you know, can I confirm or deny? So, I guess given that quote-unquote leak or whatever, I guess it's not surprising that they announced more Ninja Kamui. I will say announcing two seasons at once is a surprise. I think the first of these two seasons is called Red Vendetta. And so I'm wondering if the next one is called Blue Exorcist, but Blue Vendetta or something of that sort. Yeah. But, you know, this that red-blue theme going out throughout, you know, is Higan and his rival, who's Sai, was his name? The Craven guy, I forget his name, but they had that red and blue thing going on. Red Oni, blue Oni is a pretty common Japanese trope. And you see, you know, Devil May Cry, yada, yada, yada. That's true. So
I kind of took it more generically. I thought like red, like blood vendetta or something.
But yeah, I would say so if there was just one season announced. But since there's another season coming up, that's just where my mind went.
They're totally planning ahead, you mean? Yeah.
So like, I think in the Anime News Network press release, or the press release I was giving to Anime News Network, they'd said that Ninja Kamui was the most watched anime ever on HBO Max and also Adult Swim. I'm not sure how their metrics work, and I'm not sure if by Adult Swim you mean like the ratings on Toonami or whatnot, but it is clear that, especially given that Ninja Kamui was renewed for two more seasons at once, that Ninja Kamui was basically a mega hit. It was maybe one of the biggest hits they've ever had or something. If this press release to be believed. So I guess it's not a surprise that they would make two more seasons. I enjoyed Ninja Kamui. It wasn't necessarily a blow my mind kind of show, but I definitely enjoyed my time with it. I definitely enjoyed watching it. I think I may have enjoyed it more than our average group or something, but I still enjoyed it. I know Chug was a big fan of it too, but you know,
I thought it was pretty good. I mean, my thing is that I'm just kind of sort of surprised that I didn't realize it was so popular. Like, I thought, you know, we're pretty close to Toonami, and I kind of am surprised to hear that it had such huge ratings. So that's,
yeah, interesting. I mean, that's straight from the press release. So if you have a chance, you can check it out. It's on Anime News Network. So they're pretty much like, yeah, this is the best most viewed anime you've ever made. So like, again, HBO Max, obviously those are streaming numbers. I'm not sure how to get the Adult Swim numbers if that's ratings from Toonami, but again, they're just pretty clear. Like, yeah, this did gangbusters basically. So they just want more. And I think there's some discussion to thread about like, how can they make more? But I'm like, sure, Higan defeated Yamaji and his crew, but like, I'm sure there are other ninja clans. Maybe they fight the mafia, either from Russia or Italy or the triads or the American government, or and Joseph's still around. They can make shit up. Or maybe, I don't know, Yamaji had a long lost brother or sister or daughter or son or whatever. You know, it's not hard to come up with reasons why to more ninjas fight more ninjas. So
I think the press release also mentioned the fact that it won the Crunchyroll Award for best original anime, which is kind of silly because I know like a lot of people don't take those awards seriously. I know Crunchyroll does, but a lot of people don't. But Adult Swim did. They're like they're gonna tout that award for sure.
Yeah, I remember discussing that in a previous episode, and I think we I'm not sure if you were there or not. You may have not been there, but I remember I think the consensus me and Cicloro came to was just like, it was so available. It was like on Toonami. It was on HBO Max. Like there are other original anime that were nominated at the same time. For example, Girls Band Cry, which is a show that was sub only. And I think it gets Amazon Prime or something. Fantastic show, but the distribution was super limited. So just no one saw it basically. Whereas Ninja Kamui, again, very widely distributed. So I think that's more why it won over any other reason. But of course, as you said, Adult Swim is going to be like, take that to the bank. Put it on every sign
for sure. So. For sure. Yeah. If anything, the good news is that it was a success and it's good to see Toonami have a success like this. So,
yeah, I just want to meet one of the, when we're having those downtimes like earlier this year, I think one of the things that was maybe slightly concerning to me is that there is no more Toonami originals announced other than Rooster Fighter. And so like, obviously, there's kind of like the whole where can you get shows from, the rights issue, Crunchyroll, and so on and so forth. But to me, I think a warning sign could have been like they basically stopped making Toonami originals whatsoever. And like, because that would obviously be a sign that like it's not worth it to them anymore. But the fact that they're, you know, Ninjakami was such a success, I think that's just good for Toonami as a block as a whole. Regardless of how good the show might be, just the fact, as you said, it was such a big success, I think it's good for Toonami overall.
Yeah, exactly. That's just kind of a long way of putting it. Yeah, but I agree completely.
Yeah, especially if you're DeMarco or a Toonami person and you have to pitch to your superiors, hey, we want to produce another anime. Look at what this one did for you on Adult Swim or on Adult Swim or Max. You know, they're going to be maybe more likely to do that now.
Exactly.
So. Yeah. All right. Well, since we know that Crocodile is on limited time, he may not be able to, most likely not be able to attend the entire episode. Let's move on and we'll get into Lazarus. Lazarus episode 11, Running with the Devil. So this episode starts out with Axel on his way to get to the last prison that he was at, the one that had the warden that gave him the Hapna beta version, I guess. But there's all kinds of explosions and stuff going on in this highway to hell that he's on. And we do see that mysterious assassin heading his way. Meanwhile, Alana is with Doug, and they've made it to Pakistan, but we can kind of see that Alana is sort of hiding her potentially Hapna symptoms.
I did like the part where Doug was like, Alana, you look like you have a fever. Do you have a fever? Don't hide if you have a fever. And Alana's like, I don't have a fever. It was just like, Doug, let's figure it out immediately. I was like, I was amused, but I mean, he's a smart guy, but he just figured it out immediately.
I think Alana even says, like, let me check my temperature. Yep, it's fine. It's like 101. That is not fine.
Yeah, she's like monitoring it on her little wristband thing. But yeah, it's clearly she's lying and hiding it. And it gets worse throughout the progression of the episode, you can tell. Yeah. So we get a lot here. I'm going to kind of skim over some of the details because all that we really need to know is that the bad guy that we saw a couple of episodes ago at the big Department of Defense meeting. His name is Schneider, and he is the head of INSCOM. I thought it was ENSCOM with an E, but it's an INSCOM with an I. Anyway, they're part of the Army, and we learn, or at least Hirsch learns, that INSCOM is sending people to Pakistan to try to hunt down the Lazarus team members that are heading there. And she is really upset about this and decides to go and have a meeting with Schneider at INSCOM headquarters.
She's kind of like, she knows she's going to get captured. You know, she's
planned for it.
Right.
Yeah, I'm just curious what the plan is, what she's going to do. I mean, I guess we'll find out next episode, but like it feels like one of the instances where like, okay, did you come in here with a plan? And like, I guess clearly she did. She's not an idiot, but it's just like, I'm just curious what the fruition of that plan will be, which we didn't get to see in this episode.
Yeah, she left the note for Abel Anderson, the head of the Lazarus thing. I mean, we think of Hirsch as the leader, but really Abel, this guy, the bald guy, he kind of is the person like who created Lazarus, the one she refers to. And she left a note for him saying, I'm going to try to talk to Schneider and get him to stop, but there's a good chance I'm going to be captured doing this. So I think she had a sliver of hope that maybe she wouldn't get captured, but she was planning on it likely happening.
Yeah, I'm just curious because it's Anderson. And I think, no, Leland's staying back at base. Chris is going after Axel. We'll talk about that later. Obviously, Douglas and Alana are in Pakistan. And so is just Anderson himself going to, quote unquote, rescue Hirsch? Or
yeah, I guess, because there's no one else, right? I mean, I thought maybe Chris was going to be a part of that, but we learned she has a different responsibility in this episode, so... Yeah, and also another interesting little bit of detail that's worth mentioning is that Leland actually knows Abel Anderson. It's mentioned in passing that he actually knew.
Probably related to the fact that he's like a spy originally.
Oh, yeah, could be, yeah.
Yeah, weren't they in a photograph together in a previous episode? Leland Anderson and his, I think, Leland's father or someone else?
Maybe, I don't remember that.
Okay, I thought that's they were, but... I've dealt with.
Well, I think it's one of these little details. It's not important right now, or maybe it won't ever be, but it's something to put in your memory banks about the fact that apparently Leland and Abel, I didn't realize that they knew each other. So then we get a commercial break and we come back, and now Doug and Alana are now in Pakistan and they split up.
Because they realize they're being chased by the army guys.
Yes, that's right. Thank you for reminding me.
I'll slow them down. You're going ahead, you know, tropes. So.
Yeah. Alana gets on like a little moped type thing, and she's chasing down the Wi-Fi signal looking for Popcorn Wizard. And she catches up to her crazy looking, like, I don't know what that thing is, a Winnebago type thing. yeah, whatever that thing is, as she drives around in.
It's out in Pakistan, like it really does.
Yeah, you know, if you're trying to be a secret, like, hacker, you're kind of advertising a little bit. What you know what I mean?
You want to look unmarked van, like the plainest, most generic looking van you can find, not one that's like tie dye and like little tassels on and all the nonsense on there. But
right,
I think it was kind of funny. Like the van passes by Alana for a moment, and she like takes her a second to realize, like, oh, that's it. It's like you didn't realize the moment you saw it.
that most ridiculous looking thing. Yeah.
The thing is that if it was like a normal van, she probably wouldn't realize it at all, which is the thing.
Alana catches up, but it's just like at that moment, her fever is finally, finally catches up, and she just falls over right there. Luckily, the Popcorn Wizard hacker girl sees this, pops out. Obviously, she's going to help her. I will say that I was a little relieved that she didn't pop out of the door going,
Radical or whatever she says.
Yeah, Radical, what's up? You know, she seemed a little more tame this time.
I guess she has some awareness. Like her rival just passed out in front of her, like,
well, and that was another thing too. She called her by her hacker name too. She's like, she recognized that Alana was that hacker. I forget what she called herself, but yeah. So during all of this, we've been kind of skipping over this, but during this, we keep cutting back to sequences, amazing looking sequences of Axel and the assassin who are fighting each other. They're moving from the bridge to rooftops, to cranes, all over the place, doing some crazy stuff. They're both very, obviously very, very talented.
This is a minor criticism, but it doesn't matter, but it is something that I wish wasn't there. So I forget what it is exactly, but the Abel guy, they see footage of this.
Oh, yeah.
Or like they see like a photo or something, and he's like, oh, is that the Shadow Assassin? There's only been rumors to now, but there's an assassin in their ranks. And I'm just like, you didn't, that's kind of corny, right?
Yeah. Like, how would he know?
Like, why can't it just be an assassin, not like some mysterious shadow assassin? It's like, you didn't need that.
I thought we were going to harp on was the fact that the assassin is using grenades in broad daylight, that's the middle of the night, but like, they're on the news. If you're an assassin and you're making the news, you're a bad assassin. Like, what the fuck?
Well, maybe it's like his final mission. And as soon as he's finished, he's been compromised and he has to, I don't know, commit seppuku.
This guy's got mental problems too, as we see in this episode.
True, but if you're working for a client, you don't want to advertise the whole world like, hey, I'm doing assassining here. Like, what? Look at me, assassin stuff. Like,
I mean, it's kind of made clear to me, I'm not going to defend it too much other than to say that, like, it's pretty clear to me that he, like, doesn't care about casualties at all. And he probably is the kind of assassin that could probably blow up a building and get away with it. You know what I mean? Like, he could sneak away. So I'm thinking he just has complete disregard for human life in every respect. And
not only human life, but also the fact that he's just like gone loud. Like, he's not trying to be sneaky right now. He's just, you know, whatever gets the mission done.
Right. He'll do whatever it takes and then somehow get away, because he probably is very elusive or something. It does bend a little bit of plausibility that he could just escape from that kind of scenario, but hey, I don't know. I don't know much about assassins. Maybe they can do that.
It doesn't matter too much in grand scheme of things, but I just think if you're an assassin, you're making the evening news, you're doing a bad job.
Yeah.
But
anyway, I don't think he cares. I think he can get away with it, which I think is supposed to show how good he is.
Should care, but regardless, I guess the world's ending in a few days anyway, so.
Yeah, that's true. We do see Chris. She gets back on her big long chopper and she's out trying to find Axel. I don't know exactly why she's doing this. I think
they saw it on the news. Isn't that like they saw it on the news?
They saw him. Like, that's right.
Go rescue Axel. Cause yeah, that's why you don't be an assassin. That's why you don't make the news. Anyway.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
That all ties in the fact that they saw a photo of the assassin. They're like, oh no, Axel's being assassinated. We got to go save him.
Then we get this really, really interesting sequence where during the fight, the assassin notices a little sort of bracelet, or not bracelet, but necklace that Axel's wearing that has this little metal like wing on it. And he goes, is that Hunden's wing? Is what he asks him. Suddenly, I guess this Chinese assassin can also speak English. So this is the first time we hear him speak. And he starts freaking out. Like, the assassin starts, like, his eyes are big and wide open and he's kind of like twitching and stuff. And then we see this really coolly, stylishly animated flashback sequence from the assassin's perspective of when he was like, I guess, being trained to be an assassin or something.
It's brainwashing, you know?
Yeah, like brainwashing. And he's like this kind of neat, like cardboard flat animation style that was really creative. I don't know what else to describe it.
I like the style of the sequence, but I didn't like the substance of the sequence. Like, how many times have we heard, you are an assassin, remove your emotion, you're all about the mission, you are an assassin, blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't know. It's a little done before. The animation was cool. But
I mean, brainwashing kind of works like that. It's just super repetitive, right? So that's how, like, even in real life, when you try to brainwash someone, like, it's extremely repetitive. That's kind of how it works. So I guess maybe that didn't bother me too much, but
The more interesting thing to note about this is that I don't know what the connection here was with Axel. Why would he have this pendant? What is his connection to the assassin network? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think they're laying the groundwork.
Was he trained as an assassin at some point?
Yeah, it would certainly explain a lot of his capability, right?
That was my assumption once this went down, that like Axel and this guy were in the same assassin training program or something, and then all Axel doesn't remember. And so that's why because they've featured this necklace before. I think Axel like mentioned it once before. This is like a memento or keepsake or something of that sort. It's not appearing here for the first time.
Okay. That's surprising to me. I think I would have remembered that, but I don't remember ever seeing it before.
I think it was just in passing or something, but it wasn't like, oh, this is Hondon's wing. Like, none of that. But I think I remember Axel mentioning it like briefly. It was like something important to him or keepsake or something, but I'll have to rewatch it to be sure. But
okay. Well, whatever it is, the assassin kind of freaks out upon seeing it too.
Right. So I suspect that it's going to be like, we still have, you know, Axel's kind of got an onion. There's just layers to this guy. You know, we were introduced to him as goofy parkour guy. And he is still Goofy Pakuro guy, but there's just clearly a lot more to this character as we've revealed, like the whole Habanot testing and whatnot. I would not be surprised if like ex-assassin was stapled onto a resume of his. So, but
yeah. So the fight comes to a pretty dramatic conclusion where both are injured. Axel gets a knife into the, I think, arm or leg of the assassin, but in a much more dramatic side, Axel gets a long shaft kind of like pierced right through his abdomen.
Yeah, he's straight impaled.
Like literally like in dire straits here. And this is when Chris finally catches up to him and is there to kind of help him. But like, I'm telling you, the episode kind of ends with Axel. I know he survives, but I'm just saying like, it's pretty bad. Like it went straight through him. So
yeah, that's a pretty fatal looking wound.
I mean, it's a pretty thick spear right through his midsection. Like, I doubt you can get away with something like, oh, this missed any organs. Like, no, that definitely hit some organs.
There's yeah,
no
maybe it hit, it. Like, his kidney, and so he only has one kidney now. It'd be, like, the only thing that makes sense to me.
I'm pretty sure that spear was wider than any one singular kidney. Like,
I don't know. Well, it was big.
That was kind of my point, or all of our points, is that it's a
right.
That's a big spear through his...
Yeah. Right, it didn't miss all the organs. It hit all the organs and didn't miss all the organs. It hit all of them.
No, it's going to be something like they're going to be like, you miraculously went just past all of your organs. And so, or it's either that, or it's going to be like, well, it's whatever, 20, whatever. So they probably have better medicine.
Right. Like it's 2052, I think, is that so like medicine just better. Like if you don't, you know, so I guess they stitched them up like, cause it's, I think it's out for 4 days. Like, there's a mystery, like, does Axel survive? Who can say? Who knows? The episode ends with him bleeding out. Oh no, Axel. And then 3 minutes later, like, no, 30 seconds later, the preview for next episode is like, Axel's like in bed, just like talking, of course,
sitting in his bed. Well,
yeah, all right. Yeah. I'm glad we had there's a bit of suspense there for maybe 30 seconds, but
yeah, they probably should have picked a different moment from that episode. Anyway, all right. So, overall thoughts on this episode, Seda?
Really good action, good episode. Some of the like the assassin stuff is corny to me, but we have 2 episodes left, I think. So we have next week and then a finale for the season or series. And I don't know, like, what are they going to do when they get to the end? They're going to find Skinner and he's going to be like, okay, here's the antidote. Like, no, it's probably not going to be that simple. Like, I don't know what's going to happen. So,
Croc, what are your thoughts?
I thought it was a pretty, I mean, we've kind of remarked on the goofy elements, but overall, I thought it was a pretty solid episode. Very, like, quite strong. I'm very curious to see how this plays out. There's not much time left, and there's still, like, a lot to do. And it's like, do they save the day, or does everyone, except maybe Axel, die? Like, there's a pretty wide spectrum of possible endings. So I'm kind of excited to see how this all plays out, because I'm just really not sure. But there's a lot of potential different ways to go that I think are well executed. Equally interesting.
Yeah, I think
I will say. Oh, sorry.
Well, what were you going to say?
Oh, I do think this episode stressed to me that there was probably a lot of value in going back and watching, doing a rewatch this series. I don't know if there'll be time to do so before we do a ranking and whatnot, but like there are kind of things that I feel are hinted in previous episodes that are kind of worth coming back to. And I've even seen some previous. Or other conversations out there that are like brought up points that like, oh, maybe Popcorn Wizard actually showed up a lot earlier in the series than we expected and whatnot. I think the show is a lot more instant when you maybe initially give a credit for, and you know, is that good or bad? We'll have to see how it ends. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a lot more density here than we initially expected. And I think that's definitely worth going back and seeing how things may have been hinted at or teased or threads laid out. And so, I'm pretty... I thought it was a strong episode. I'm very curious to see how it ends. And I think there's just many different ways it could end. And that's kind of exciting. Like, again, they could fuck it up, but I think that uncertainty is kind of exciting. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. And they're probably going to, I assume they're going to put this in a rerun slot and I might watch the rerun. So
yeah, once this runs, I'm sure we'll get one of those.
Oh, one more thing I'll add is that because Seto was saying this is kind of funny and it kind of made me think of Ninja Comedy a bit. Like, we're going to get the end of the show in 2 weeks. They'll call the season finale. I think we often joke how, like, oh, Toronto always calls a season finale, but that's always the end of the show. But Ninja Comedy was actually one instances where it actually ended up being a season finale. They were not like joking, like it actually ended up being just one season of many. So I'm just kind of, that was a little funny thing that came to mind. And so I guess we'll see how definitive or not definitive the ending of Lazarus is. But
so my thinking on the episode was that I thought it was pretty good. I think my biggest take is that I am enjoying the fact that things are starting to come together. I feel like answers are coming, and things that have been kind of prepped up and earlier in the season are coming. We're going to learn more about those now and what the machinations about behind everything are. So, and the action was really, really great. So, but it almost always is great in this show.
Yeah. Like that's one thing that's pretty hard to criticize in this show. I think a lot of the action animation is really well done.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, let's move on to Dragon Ball Daima. Episode 1, Conspiracy. So before we do the breakdown, because this was a 45-minute long episode, actually, which was pretty interesting. Before we do that, since Crocodile's going to need to go pretty soon, why don't you give your overall thoughts on just this episode?
Well, I thought it was a good kind of reminder, and I think that struck out most of me is how strong the production is. It's like so rare to have an actual Dragon Ball TV series where the production is not only spectacular at the start, but it's great in the middle, it's great in the end. It's just the show overall is kind of a visual tour de force. And sometimes it gets, actually, I would say, movie quality like.
Oh, totally.
It doesn't maybe like flex its might necessarily in this beginning episode, but it's still quite
beautiful. Are you kidding?
Let me rephrase that. Having seen a series, I know it gets like actually a lot better. So wow. Like this is actually pretty, like relatively speaking, this is not the strongest foot the show puts forth in regards to its art and animation and even like music and stuff of that nature. So maybe that's like, it is great. It's just, I know it gets a lot better. And in certain circumstances, it's like, it's up there with like some of the best Dragon Ball movies. So yeah. I Amazing. Think that's, to me, the thing that stands out the most out of the beginning episode is just, it looks great, it feels great, it sounds great. It's it does a really good recap of the Buu saga. I think it's just like, it feels very cozy and familiar because we're back with these, you know, the Dragon Ball crew is like an eternal anime family. It's, you know, it's just, it's comfort food, but it's like, it's just well-cooked, well-presented. Nothing here in narrative is mind-blowing. I think the only thing I would say is that I think Goma and Degasu's concern about, like, if Goku and friends came to Demon Realm, they could fuck their shit up. So, oh, we should stop them. But, like, by quote-unquote stopping them, they actually encouraged Goku and friends to come to Demon Realm because otherwise Goku and his friends would just probably leave him alone. So it's kind of like they're trying to avoid the confrontation, but they kind of cause the confrontation in a kind of ironic kind of way. That's something kind of narrative that stands out. It's kind of funny. But it ends up being a fun little adventure. So it's like, I guess worth it, but just, that's kind of like, you should just left, you poked a sleeping bear. I get, you know, you're afraid that if the bear ever woke up, it'd fuck you up, but you poked it and now it's awake and you just fucked yourself up. So that's a little bit of that there.
Yeah,
that's kind of my big takeaway other than then like, that is just like, the show's great. It feels like comfort food. It tastes great. There's a lot of little funny lore drops. I think they kind of mentioned something about the background of Namekians, like the Namekians.
That was interesting. Yeah, I wanted to talk about that.
And then they moved to Universe 7, and that's how it ended on Namek, and then some of them ended on Earth. And then so, like, this little bit of lore bits, and I think there's also maybe a few retcons, but, like, none of those are really a big deal. Like, Kubito and Supreme Kai shouldn't be defused right now, technically, if going by Super, but whatever. Like, clearly, Supreme Kai needed to be defused for him to be part of the show, and he makes a good contribution throughout the series, so whatever. But yeah, it's good Dragon Ball comfort food. It's good to be back. It looks great, sounds great. I think those are the main things I'd say about the opening episode. A good episode, sets the plot forward pretty well. Oh, also, I guess Goku and Goten never get to be teenagers, I guess. So, like, it's a little joke, so that's kind of they're back to being babies. Like, what do you mean for me to grow up? And then they just will not grow up. I mean, Superhero was, they did in that movie. That was a good movie. But again, that whole joke about them never growing up. So,
yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for giving your feedback on the first episode of Dragon Ball Daima. Do you want to head out now?
Yeah. One other thing, as I say, just with regards to One Piece, thank God it's finally over. apparently, I guess that Coco Beam Struggle is not in the manga, but I think that was when we won a few times. I thought that Beam Struggle was kind of warranted because it's the big bad is Doflamingo. Though it's kind of funny that like Luffy's plan is like, all right, punching hard didn't work, so I'll punch him even harder and that'll work. And then like, I guess the fight had to end, so I guess yay, but like, you'd think there'd be a little more strategy there. One good thing I'll mention, maybe a real good moment, I remember Leo being like, oh man, we're fucked. It's over. It's curtains. And then Robin just like, the calmest, sweetest, demure voice was like, nah, Luffy's got this. I believe in my captain. And I thought that was a really nice moment. Like, I don't know if it's like worthy of nomination or anything, but just, I don't know, something about that was just really cool. Because Robin is always a character who's kind of like on the outside looking in. And now it's just...
It was a nice moment. I also couldn't help but think that Leo would just be like, oh, okay. Of course, what you say is always true, so I believe you. I don't think he does in that moment, but I'm just thinking that.
Right, but I just felt coming from Robin, just in the trajectory of her character being like an outside looking in and now just part of crew and now having full faith in Luffy. And obviously it's not the first time she expressed that, but just a very nice moment in the whole ordeal. And so that was nice.
It was a nice moment. It was a nice bit. It's always nice to see the Straw Hats have faith in Luffy. I mean, that's what he brings to the table, you know.
Especially when Robin is usually the one that's like, don't worry, the worst that can happen is we all die.
Yeah, our skin will fall off.
Like spiders crawl up or urethra or something.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Anyway, that's all I have to say. But anyway, I got to head out. So it was good. Happy I was able to make it, and I'll talk to you guys later.
All right, thanks for coming.
All right, bye.
All right, so let's go into Dragon Ball Daima. Like we talked about, this is episode one, Conspiracy, and this sort of started out with a really, really long, but actually somewhat entertaining recap of the Buu saga. It's basically this new character named King Goma, who is the king of the demon realm, and his, I guess, assistant sort of thing. It's a brother of the Supreme Kai.
Yeah, so I am not up to date on like Dragon Ball lore, and like so I haven't seen like Superhero or some of the later movies or whatever.
I haven't either.
So I don't know what's related there. Like I've seen Dragon Ball Z, I've seen Super. Like okay, we knew Deborah from the Buu saga was from the Demon World realm and he was king of the Demon Realm, but that didn't like mean anything at the time. You're just like, oh, he's just some dude from some demon realm that we've never seen. Like, who are they? Who knows? It probably doesn't matter, but apparently it does matter. And yeah, this whole section, sorry, real quick, this whole section just kind of introduces a lot of elements, like the Namekians are actually from here, which is kind of an interesting like reversal of definitions of what Namekians are. And then like the Supreme Kais are also from here, or at least related in some degree. Because I think even someone says, I think Dende even says when like later in the episode, like, are you a Kai? And what's his name? I forget his name. Degasu is like, easy mistake to make. Like, so he's not a Kai, but those that race of people become Kais or something like that.
I like this sort of idea that the Namekians were living on their planet Namek, but it was just like that wasn't their home. That they actually came from the demon realm, and like I think that's when like Goma or somebody tells Dende is like, oh yeah, well you came, you know, your tribe came from there too. You can just tell by your pointed ears. And it's like, oh yeah, all the Namekians have pointed ears and so do all the demons. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of neat. Kind of, I mean, I don't know if he planned that all along, but I like it. So yeah, anyway, yeah. So Desigu and Goma are watching the recap for the audience, but it's very entertaining. And like Crocodile said, and I'll just say it now because I don't want to keep repeating this, but like the production value in this episode, like blew me away. I can't stress enough how absolutely amazing it looked. And it wasn't like it was like good and there were moments of Sakuga. It was like the whole thing looked like the quality you get from like a movie. Like every reaction shot, every shot of a character walking into frame, everything always looked really polished and animated and clever and sharp and colorful. I don't know. It just looks so good. I don't know if you felt that way, but I just was blown away.
I feel like there weren't, like, besides Goku and Vegeta, like, skirmishing a little bit, which did look good, there weren't any, like, huge Sakuga moments like you mentioned. But yeah, just overall, there were just, it looked really good, like, overall.
I would have to, like, point it out to you, like, shot for shot. But I'm telling you, as someone who loves animation, and I know you do too, but, like, for someone who loves animation, I just kept noticing things. I kept noticing little character flares and little bits of extra animation all over the place where they were just doing little extra work that was not necessary for a TV anime. And I was just like, that looks way better than most shows do. And it was just so, it looked so good. Anyway, and it was greatly voiced too. I thought all of the voice actors were bringing it. This, the guy, whoever's voicing Goma, is like really funny and very, has a kind of very natural way that he talks. That is, it doesn't sound like a performance. It just sounds like he's just like a snarky, jerky guy. It's just really convincing and great. Okay. So I've said my piece about that, and to hear Crocodile say that the show looks better in the future, I'm just like, my God, I don't know. Anyway, I kind of actually feel like this show, this episode will look really good and next week it won't. So I don't know, but cause it looks so good. We also are introduced to another character who comes walking in. It's a rather sexy looking, Supreme Kai looking woman named Anisu, who is Desigu's sister. Now, she's introduced as Desigu's sister. Desigu is introduced as the Supreme Kai's brother. Is this a situation where they're just all related, or is there, like, literally a family here? I don't know.
I don't know. Or maybe, like, I guess, does that make her the Supreme Kai's sister, or are they, like, half siblings to each other?
Yeah. Is it, like, or literal sister, like, or is it just, like, all Kais are related? I don't know.
Like all Namekians, right?
Yeah, well, that's a little different, though. Aren't they, like,
Namek?
Yeah, aren't they all, like, birthed from the same?
Yeah, they're, like, asexual.
Something like that. Yeah. Anyway, I don't think we're supposed to think too much about it, but I do feel like, yeah. You know, anyway, she did mention that she's related. So she appears to be super smart, probably smarter than, well, certainly everyone's smarter than Goma, but like, probably even smarter than Desigu here, kind of like. She claims to be a scientist. And we also learned that she actually went to Earth during the events of one of the previous arcs. We didn't see that, but she was there, apparently. They learn about the Earth Dragon Balls, and they say there's 7 of them, but they're really small and apparently very easy to get compared to the, I don't know, 3 that they have in the demon realm that are all protected by these super insect looking guardians that I guess are impossible to get. Now I know where this is going. I haven't seen this, and you're probably on the same page, but I can tell where this is going. The kids, I mean, we'll get to it, but they get turned into kids.
They need to wish themselves back to them, to their normal selves. So they need to get the demon realm Dragon Balls.
Right. Which means fighting the 3 guys that they talked about, like, over and over in this episode. Yeah. So yeah, that's pretty much, I'm sure, the setup. Anyway, so then we get the commercial break, and they summon this old Namekian who is very stinky and kind of senile. His name's Neva, and they're like, okay, we need to take you with us to the outside world. They don't call it Earth. They just call it the outside world. And then to do this, they fly in their little pod to this, I don't know what this thing is. It's like a mechanical ship in the shape of a fish that talks.
Yeah, it's like some sort of like it's some sort of like space between realms, and that's like some sort of like realm guardian or something.
Yeah, so. it's like, I can't tell if, I mean, it's, I can't tell if it's artificial or if it's, I don't know what it is, but anyway, they fly into its mouth, and then there are little submersions of it inside, and then they're like, "Where do you want to go? We can take you to any universe, any planet." And they're like, well, we need to go to Universe 7, which we've learned about Universe 7 being a thing from Dragon Ball Super. Oh, and by the way, it's worth mentioning, and I didn't know this until like halfway through the episode, and someone posted this in the thread on Reset Era, that this takes place before Super.
Yes.
I don't know why that wasn't obvious to me, but
apparently it doesn't really fit very well before Super. Like, if you, like, some of the, there's enough, from what I've heard, there's enough, like, discrepancies in timelines where it's like, yeah, it sort of fits between, like, Z and Super, but there's a few things that kind of just don't make sense that if you were to slot it there, where it kind of just falls out of the timeline.
Really?
I mean, I don't really care that much.
No, like, I don't think I can remember enough to pick those things out, but.
Well, I think, for example, I think Dende is supposed to be older now, but he's not. And it's like, why is Dende still a kid? He shouldn't be.
Yeah.
But.
Well, he's only a kid for one episode, and then he's a really little kid, as we'll see. So anyway, they travel through the, like, wormhole or whatever and head towards Earth. And meanwhile, we finally, after, like, I don't know, 30 minutes, we finally get to see the actual Dragon Ball crew. So it's everybody's celebrating Trunks' ninth birthday, excuse me. And they're having some kind of big celebration, and everybody is there, pretty much everybody.
Yep.
Pretty cool. I don't know. It's kind of a nice little introduction. This is where we kind of learn some weird things, like the retconny things, like, wait a minute, Supreme Kai and what's his face? They're no longer merged. And they have, like, some offhand comment about, like, they Boo has the power to, like, eat them and spit them out as separate people or something. It was kind of, okay, whatever. Like,
sure, why not? Okay.
Going into his mouth, like, undoes the whatever those earrings are called.
Potara.
Anyway, and then there's that, and then we just sort of see everybody there.
So the demon guys show up on Dende's little lookout.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, and I think we skipped over the fact that they learned that the sister left before them. Right?
You mean now? Because I thought, or is that in addition to her having been there before? Is that in addition to that? See, I thought it was that she had, they learned that she had been to Earth once before.
I was thinking that she had left before them.
Well, maybe she did.
I guess it's ambiguous.
Yeah, I don't know.
She's obviously going to show up again. We don't know.
Oh, of course. She appears to, my impression of her is that she's got some plan that's in motion right now. Yeah.
Yeah, she doesn't care about this Demon King business. She has her own thing. Who knows what it is, but.
Oh, yeah. There was one other offhand comment that I wanted to mention before we talk about the stuff with what's that place called up in the sky? Gosh darn it, the Watchtower or something?
Like the Lookout?
The Lookout, thank you. Yeah, anyway, before we get there, Goku does mention that he wished for everyone to have forgotten about the evil Boo so that the good Boo could remain on Earth and that people would like him. I don't remember that thing a thing in Super. Maybe he mentioned that in Super. I just think that's interesting because, you know, Boo killed lots of people and stuff. And I guess, like, Goku was like, well, he's good now. Everyone forget. And, you know, it's one of his wishes, I guess. Oh, it's interesting. Anyway, sure. Like you said, yeah. Goma and Degasu arrive at the lookout, and Dende is there with his servant guy. I forget his name.
Mr. Popo,
yeah. Whose only real line in this episode is, would you like some tea? anyway, shows up and it's like Dende's really surprised. Oh my gosh, it's another Namekian. Who are you? And we learn that this guy, Neva, this old Namekian, he's lived for over 1,000 years and he created the Dragon Balls in the demon realm. So he has, like, super Dragon Ball knowledge and is able to just, with a whim, to everyone's surprise, just summon the Dragon Balls. He didn't have to search for them, he just summons them. The Earth.
And not only that, but they're rocks because they've been used recently, and normally they take a year to respawn, right? We know that. That was established a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And then he has the power just to power them up no matter the state they're in. Just turn them back into active Dragon Balls. So he has, and Dende on both of these is like, how did you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess as someone who can create Dragon Balls, he just has that ability. He's pretty wild. Anyway, so they immediately, he's like, oh, I did think it was funny that, like, he's like, I'm never going to give you the password. And he's like, I don't need your password. I watched the review or the review of the series or something like that.
It's like, we have it on camera.
Yeah, or yeah, we had it on tape or something like that. It's like, I saw what you said. So they summon Shenron, and everybody back at the party is like, sky's getting dark. Kind of looks like someone summoned Shenron. That can't be. How's that possible?
Yeah, I think even Bulma says, like, well, the rocks or the Dragon Ball shouldn't even be you know, active right now, so they can't be Shenron.
Yeah.
So
anyway, that the whole plan, like I said all along. Oh yeah, I didn't really mention this earlier, but anyway, Goma comes up with the plan. He said you can't use the Earth Dragon Ball to kill people because that's evil. Apparently, it doesn't grant those kinds of wishes.
And he even says these are white magic balls or whatever, and not dark magic balls. Like, okay.
Yeah, different types of magic. Yeah. I'm assuming in the demon realm, you can probably wish someone dead. Probably. But anyway, can't do it with the earth ones. So his idea is, he's like, how can we limit them? And so his wish to the Shenron is to wish all of the people who defeated Boo, including their friends, to be younger. And then there's kind of a funny sequence where Shenron's like, you need to be more specific. And he's like, okay, I don't know, make them like 8 years old.
I think they say first grade. They don't even give an age. They just say first grade. So
he's like, first grade, which I don't, how does he know what first grade is? But anyway.
Yeah, I guess first grade in the US would be like seven.
Yeah,
six or
but
seven,
I guess even right? in the demon realm, first grade is seven. I don't know. So. Anyway, but then he's like, well, what about the children? And he's like, make them babies. So that's how the episode ends. We kind of hear the, I guess, what's probably the theme song for the show starts to play. And we see all of the Dragon Ball Z characters turning into kids. And I guess like the really young ones like Trunks and stuff will be babies now. Didn't really see that, but I think they are.
It is a very broad and vague wish because it's like Goku and all his friends. It's like, well, how do we determine who is a friend or not? Like, how much of a friend do you have to be caught up in this wish?
Yeah, it would have been better if they were like everyone at that party. That would have been
and
easier.
The preview for the next episode showed that like all of the like servants or you know just the you know just the randoms that are you know probably working for Capsule Corp or whatever, they're all normal because they're not friends.
Right.
But everyone else.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's Shenron. He probably knows somehow magic. He knows who's their friends, who's like, he probably can sense that or something. Also, not to go too much into the preview, but I do want to say, I heard that they have different voice actors once they turn into children. Which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. Other than the other thing I think is interesting though, is that like, what's the big haired guy called?
Hercule.
Or yeah.
Mr. Satan.
I liked his voice in the preview, like his kid voice. And I think it's interesting too, that like, he's like the same age as everyone else. Cause he's technically older, right? In real life. But I guess the wish is that all of the Z fighters and their friends will all be first graders. So even Hercule is the same age as like Goku and Vegeta now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that's kind of neat. So there we go. The first episode of Daima. I will just start out by saying that I was much more impressed by this episode than I was expecting. Cause I've heard like people are like, oh, it's like GT or something like that. It's like GT 2.0 or something. And I'm like, it can't be that bad. Well, it's certainly not that bad. I think it's way better than that. And I thought it was actually really funny and entertaining. I thought the new like King Goma character was really fun. Like, I don't know. It works because it takes itself less seriously and is more fun. And that's kind of my feelings on it. What about you?
I feel like a lot of people are going to try to get tripped up into like lore and like canon and like, how does this work with Super after it or whatever. But I kind of feel, I don't know what happens. I haven't seen the show. I kind of feel like you kind of just have to like, just accept it for what it is. And like, yeah, there's some stuff might not, you know, the explanations might not hold 100% water or whatever. It's fine. It's not that serious. So.
Yeah.
And I like that the presentation is great. So.
Oh yeah. Again, I kind of was expecting Super. I mean, if you took an episode of Super and you compared it to this, you would notice immediately how much better this looks. It just looks so much better. But I think it was like Crocodile, like two episodes ago on our podcast, he said something to the effect of like, this show sort of starts, it is mostly very much more like original Dragon Ball, but then at the very close to the end, it starts to get more like Z. And
that's not what I've heard.
Yeah, and I kind of take that to mean, like, I think most of this show is going to be much more lighthearted and fun and adventure-y, and then towards the end, it's going to be, you know, key blasts and, you know, that kind of stuff is what I'm expecting.
Yeah.
All right. It's good to see Dragon Ball on the block, and especially if it's this good. I hope it stays this good. I thought it was really good. I'm not a big Dragon Ball fan, but I don't know. I thought that was really fun.
I agree.
All right, let's move on to Bleach. Bleach Episode 5, Wrath as a Lightning.
What? Okay. Wrath as a Lightning.
These episode titles.
I'm bemused at the title. Okay.
They've all been like this. They've all been weird.
Well, yeah, sure.
I think this is par for the course for Bleach, maybe. Anyway, I don't remember a character named Akon. I know he's the head of the, like...
He's like one of the communications guys on the phone. I don't remember where he, like, his rank or his squad or whatever, but he's just one of the guys on the phone that's like, we got to get Ichigo. So,
well, I mean, Ichigo knows him because he actually, like, gets a call from him on the cell phone. And he's like, Akon, what's going on over there? And he can hear through the cell phone, like, all of these. They're like, it's like FBI quarters for the Soul Society or something. I don't know how to describe it. I also think it's funny that the Soul Society has computers, but maybe not worth going into that.
Yeah.
But they're like, we're monitoring Ichigo. He's stuck between worlds. And then suddenly they're being attacked by the bad guys. We cut back. We see that the bad guy named Jay is sliced in half. Who sliced him in half? Do you remember? I don't remember.
Oh, so they didn't show this.
Oh.
And apparently in the manga, I saw people commenting in the thread that it was way more obvious in the manga who it was. But in the anime, they hide it. And apparently it's not revealed for quite a while. So it's meant to be mysterious. Like, who saved, you know, who saved everyone there? Now, I may be way off. I'm going off of, like, fuzzy Bleach memories of a long time ago. And I'm, you know, it's been a long time since I've watched a lot of Bleach. But I'm like, maybe Yoroichi?
Okay.
I don't remember. Yoroichi, I remember, is the purple-haired, dark-skinned, like, woman who was, like, a former Soul Reaper. And she's, like, around. I don't remember, like, where she normally hangs out.
She's the dark-skinned girl who's, like, a cat, right?
Yeah, she can become a cat.
Okay.
So I know she's like around. I don't know where she like hangs out. And this is where my memories are fuzzy. Like, would she have possibly been there in that moment at that time? I don't know. But I'm like, that's my first guess, is maybe it was her. But I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think we've seen her that I remember.
Yeah. Right. I don't think she's shown up in this series yet.
It would make sense for her to be there, if only because she's there to protect Orihime and Chad, you know. Possibly. Mm-hmm. So I'm with you on that. That makes sense. You're right. I haven't seen her, and that she's a pretty popular character. So that makes sense, I think. So anyway, we cut back to the Soul Society, and we see this masked Quincy guy who's got like spikes on his mask, who wears like a, you know, like a mask over his mouth type thing. And he's using his arrows, because like you said, I guess all the Quincys use some kind of arrow typically. Anyway, his arrows, when hit you, they make you fearful. They give you fear. That's his like power. So he's probably the F. I don't know if that's what's stated, but that's my guess.
I don't remember.
Yeah, it's not important. Anyway, that guy is hitting he's the one, Byakuya, who is
Byakuya Kuchiki, who is Rukia's brother, their brother and sister.
That's what I was trying to think.
It's her older brother. Yeah.
Yeah. He was like one of the big bads in like a long earlier arc.
Yeah. He's one of the captains. So he's one of the captains of the squads. I forget which squad. And yeah, when the Soul Society squads were basically all like adversaries, of course, he was like a main one. So
yeah. And it made sense too, because like, I think at that time it was all about trying to rescue Rukia, and then Byakuya was like her brother. So that was like a big thing.
Yeah. Kind of like family or like duty or family, that sort of stuff. So,
right. I won't go into details other than to say that Byakuya, Renji, and Rukia are all pretty much put out.
Yeah.
In the next scene or two, they're basically all defeated.
Yep.
Things are going pretty dire for the Soul Society. So we get a commercial break, and when we come back, we see Kenpachi walking up on the main big bad guy, Yui Baha, and his like lieutenant. And he's just got like three Stern Ritters bodies and is like dragging them by their hair or something.
He's already taken out three of our, if there's one for each of the alphabet, three of them.
Well, they even gave them names. Did you see they gave them like name cards?
Yeah. And they're all dead.
They're dead. Yeah. But yeah.
So I remember Kenpachi's thing was he's also a captain, and he is like so ridiculously strong. He doesn't even have a Bankai, but he's still like ridiculously strong anyways. And that's just kind of how he's always been. So it's like, wow, Kenpachi has taken out three of the Stern Ritters and he's going to take on the boss. That doesn't go well though.
No, it doesn't ultimately. And it's all off screen. Unfortunately, we don't get to see the battle, which is fine. I don't mind that sometimes as a narrative device to be like, he was so strong and then you don't see him defeated. That's fine. But I did like his cocky nature walking up to the big bad, and even that guy that was with him. And he's like, I don't have time to talk to you. I'm here for him. And it's like, he was pretty badass in that moment. I like this guy. I kind of vaguely remember Kenpachi. I remember he had like a little girl that would follow him around too, call him Ken.
I think that's his lieutenant. Yeah.
Oh, it was lieutenant. Okay.
I forget her name, but yeah, it's kind of a weird dichotomy.
Where she would always call him like Kenny or something like that. I just remember that. But then, the thing I just like about him though is that like, and especially when he heard that like Ichigo was on the way, he's like, hell yeah. You know, he was like into it. He's like, I'm all about that. That's fucking cool. I don't know. Pretty cool. Anyway, yes, it's a bummer he's defeated. I don't think he's dead, but anyway.
Yeah.
Then we meet Stern Ritter O, the Overkill. And he is being he's attacking somebody, and then he gets blocked by the old guy, the head captain.
Yeah, I remember the guy that he's attacking, like I recognize him, but he's kind of like one of those dudes from Bleach, you know, like, oh yeah, I recognize that guy. I have no idea what his name is or his power or anything. Like, oh yeah, just one of those dudes. So
O stole the head captain's lieutenant's Bankai and he tries to use it against him here. And then we get this sort of flashback, which I think is kind of neat because it explains where the old guy got his name. And I won't go into the details, but it just has to do with the fact that Chojiro, his lieutenant, called him EJ Sai based on the scar on his head. That had something to do with the Japanese symbol. And then later he like got a different version of that scar on his head that changed his name. So that's how he got his name. I didn't even write down what his real name is, but whatever. Just sort of a flashback. And he's like, basically says, you know, it's basically all building up to the fact that like, you know, you have his Bankai, but you don't know how to use it. And he kills O in just basically one fiery slice. And the old guy
is really pissed off.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he's freaking mad. And I like that like everybody reacts to it. They're like, holy shit, I can feel his spiritual pressure. He's like pissed. But it also gives all lieutenants like hope. They're like, oh, he's on his way. I feel strong now. Yeah, at that moment, the tide kind of changes a little and people start like the Soul Society captains start like getting back on their feet, I guess.
And he's heading straight towards the Quincy boss, Yawabawa, or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
And it looks like the preview for the next episode is basically a big encounter of those two people.
It's surprising. I wouldn't have expected that this soon.
Now, the thing is I highly doubt he's going to win.
No.
Because we're only on episode 6.
Of like a multi-season thing.
Right. Yeah. So something's going to happen.
Yeah. Unless the big bad gets replaced by someone else. It doesn't make sense, but I mean, it's probably their first fight, you know? So, and that's when it's revealed that Kenpachi was defeated because that Yui Bawa or whatever his name is holding him up by his neck, basically in the air. Mm-hmm. So, you know, pretty action-packed episode. A lot of stuff happening. And as predicted, Ichigo is just stuck in the jail yelling. And I think that's going to be for a little while, I assume.
He has to arrive just too late.
Yeah, at the last second, I suppose. Yeah. Any other thoughts about this?
The next episode looks like it might be pretty cool. Just a big fiery fireball of a battle between two old dudes.
Yeah. It'll be nice to see the Yui Baha guy kind of show off his abilities. I don't think we've really seen that. So I wonder if the old guy will die.
He feels too important to die, but maybe he will. I mean, I guess. If I had a guess, he gets like put out of commission somehow. Like he gets defeated and he can't fight, but won't die. That's my thought. Maybe he'll die.
My thinking is that he might die. Maybe not right in this next episode, but I think he would die because this is the last arc of Bleach, right? Like, this is it.
I think so.
Like, the Thousand-Year Blood War, I think, is how the manga ends, I believe. I think. Actually, I don't know. I thought it was.
I don't know.
I don't know either. I thought it was. But even then, it's like I said, it blew me away when I learned that the Thousand-Year Blood War wasn't just a season. So,
yeah.
Multiple seasons. I thought the episode was pretty entertaining overall. It was easier to follow than some of the earlier episodes. I'm starting to kind of get my head around the characters a little more.
Yeah, probably won't remember all the names, but that's fine.
Yeah. And it's like I said before, it's still entertaining even if you don't know everybody's name. You know, you can kind of just go mm-hmm. with the flow. All right, let's move on to Blue Exorcist. Blue Exorcist Episode 5, Mysterious Connections. This is at least one episode title that does make sense. I understand what that's about. I took very brief notes on this episode. I did want to start out by mentioning that the very first thing that happens in this episode is that the old master guy walks right up behind Shura and then just slaps her on the ass.
But actually, she was delivering a message, so it was okay. I'm joking. I don't endorse this.
No, it was like, I get it. That's the trope. He's like a Roshi type character, I guess, as well as being a mysterious monk. She takes it in stride, but whatever. And it turns out that Yukio and his team have arrived in Tokyo. We do learn, probably later in the episode, but I'll mention it here. What they were doing was trying to find the bad guy with the other eye.
Yeah.
And that's why they were like hunting down those. And then that car they ran into a couple episodes ago that had like the two burned up exorcists in it, that was just like a diversion. So anyway, they've arrived in not Tokyo, Kyoto.
Kyoto, yeah.
Yeah. We then see Mamushi has escaped and she meets back up with Toto, and it's revealed that the eye that they stole is actually in her socket. She actually has the eye in her eye socket.
Yep. Mamushi's actually a little older than I thought. Like, they bring out like her like file and it says she's 24 years old.
And I'm like, whoa, oh, really?
I thought she would be like, yeah. I'm like, oh, I thought she was just kind of like a teenager like the rest of them. But yeah, or at least maybe like 20. But like, oh, she's 24.
She looks exactly the same age as Shiemi to me. So yeah, I didn't know that. Okay. Huh, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I would not have pegged her as like adult woman. No. Young adult still, but still like in anime, 24 is pretty old.
So. Yeah, that's elderly in anime. That's what literally, I mean, I jokingly say that, but it is frustrating when you hear like shonen protagonists calling like a 24-year-old old man. They do that all the time.
Actually, how old is she? I'm looking up how old is Shura. Shura is 27. Okay. I was like, she's not older than Shura, is she? I can believe that Shura is 27.
Yeah, that fits. Her design works for 27. I get that.
But Mamushi if you would have asked me before that episode, I was like, oh, she's just like a teenager like the rest of them. She looks like any of the class maids. Like, I don't
know. I didn't know. I didn't, until you mentioned it, I assumed she was a teenager. So,
yeah.
And we also learned that Rin has been confined to solitary confinement in the sort of jail underneath the temple. That's, and, you know, Shura basically lets, Yukio know that that's what's going on. And she kind of brings, there's like a scene where she sort of brings everyone, him up to speed about everything that's happened.
Mm-hmm.
Commercial break, come back. We learn that Yukio hates Shura. She finds it funny. This is my note. I'm kind of reading my note here and I'm trying to remember what.
Yeah. So I think Shura says something like, you got to loosen up. You gotta not be so buttoned up all the time. Those are the people that, you know, usually have things go wrong, or I think get turned is what the way she phrased it. And then he's like, all right, fine then. I've always hated you. And then she laughs at it.
Oh, okay. That's yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I liked her reaction there. That was fun. She's kind of one of my favorite characters on this show. And not just because she's a big booby girl, but like, I don't know. She just feels
she's like competent, where all the other, like a lot of the other student characters are kind of, you know, fledgling, you know, they're obviously trainees. So she's got agency.
She's worldly and knowledgeable and capable. And like, I don't know. It's not that I have a thing against like the trope of anime always being about high school students. I don't mind that too much, but it's kind of refreshing when you get a fun adult character.
Yeah.
It's not common, and she's one of those characters. I like that. We get a scene where we see that Shimmy is, you know, still doing her stuff.
They're just kind of doing chores.
Yeah.
And the other girl comes in. What's the other girl's name?
Let's just call her Eyebrows.
Eyebrows comes in, and they basically do start talking about like Rin and Yukio. I was about to say like they almost passed like the Bechdel test, like where they were talking about just like helping out. And then they, of course, start talking about the protagonist. Like, well, that's not unexpected, but whatever. But, you know, Shiemi kind of feels like she couldn't do anything for Rin when he was, you know, having his control problems and like lashing out. And, you know, she said she was, I don't know if she said she was scared, but the way she phrased it was like she felt powerless. She couldn't do anything, and she wants to be able to do something. So that was the gist of it.
Izumo, the Eyebrows girl, kind of helps her realize what's going on. She's always sort of like the sounding board for Shiemi to kind of like get in touch with her feelings and stuff. And yeah, she's kind of like, once again, Shiemi's kind of resolve has been boosted again. So anyway, the old guy, Bond's dad, the monk, the master, as they call him in the show, he had left a note for Rin to read in the jail, but unfortunately nobody can read it. Well, not Rin and Shura can't read it because it's written in like Japanese cursive, but of course Yukio's here and he's super smart, so he can read it. And so he starts to read it, which then transitions into sort of the backstory of the master, Bond's dad, and like a flashback of what was going on.
He fit a lot on that little scroll.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. I don't know what it says. Oh, I wrote down Tatsuma, and I'm like, what's that? Oh, that's his name. So that's what Bond's dad's name is, Tatsuma.
Yeah, and so it's basically a long flashback. And it's really just kind of boils down to how he met Shiro, who is Rin's foster dad.
Yeah, it ultimately comes to that. And we see the original, like there's like that eternal flame that they were always supposed to keep going or whatever. And then that like gets knocked over when we see this unknown exorcist come flying in, defeating a demon. And then we pan up and we see it is a young Shiro standing on the roof, and he's got the Komasaur. He doesn't have it, but he sees it there. And he's like, oh, look, the Komasaur. I'll take this. And he's just going to steal it, I guess, or take it.
So we already kind of knew, I'm going by memory here, from like the first few episodes, that Shiro was kind of an oddball monk. Like, he was kind of on, you know, his own beat and whatnot. But here we really get that he's kind of like a, almost like a loose trigger, right? Just kind of, you know, irreverent, not really one for formalities or rules at all. He just kind of does what he wants, it seems like. So
yeah, totally.
And I'm assuming we'll see more of this and how this must, you know, how, yeah, I'm assuming there's got to be more to this in terms of how Rin and Bone, how they all like relate to this whole issue with these demon eyes.
So. You know, we had a couple of episodes ago where, like you pointed it out, there was this scene about that was kind of like the showing how Rin kind of connected with Tatsuma, Bon's dad, about like, oh, you're very similar to my dad. And seems like that similarity goes further back, or, you know, or maybe not similarity, but connection is going to be explored even more about the dichotomy slash similarities between Bon's dad and Rin's dad. And I think that's probably ultimately what's going to bring Bon on the table with Rin. You know what I mean? Like being cool with him again. I'm just thinking out loud here.
No, but that just seems right to me.
Yeah. But yeah, it was kind of fun to see him pop up at the end of the episode, because we haven't seen him in forever, of course, because he's dead, but kind of neat to see him back in the show. Overall, pretty good episode. Again, I feel like kind of like with Lazarus, I feel like the pieces were put out onto the table in the first several episodes, and now the answers are starting to come about what's going on and who's doing what and why. We still don't know what the big, you know, what Toga or whatever his name is, the bad guy. Like, we don't know what his Toto. We don't know what his goal is, what he's trying to achieve. They did mention something about that there was like some risk that there was going to produce like the world, like a worldwide miasma, some kind of miasma that would, you know, take over the world.
Oh, right. I totally forgot about this. They're like a new type of miasma. If the eyes come together.
Yeah. Like almost like world ending, or maybe, I don't know, city ending in the very least. So yeah, that's something to do with that. Okay. Well, let's finish off the episode with One Piece. One Piece, episode 733, Attack on a Celestial. Luffy's King Kong Gun of Anger. Yats announces that Luffy is back in action, and he is. Got super quick notes here for One Piece. They're very easy. Luffy is kind of getting beaten a lot at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, the first half of this episode was, honestly, Luffy's back, but he wasn't doing a lot at all, and even Doflamingo was like, is this it? This is what you came back for? So,
yeah, he's getting beaten a lot. He hasn't even really thrown a punch yet, because we know he can only throw one punch per the story. But yeah, he's just sort of taking it, getting knocked into walls and stuff. But I thought the one thing that was kind of interesting that I didn't remember is that Doflamingo does use his strings on Luffy briefly. He starts to manipulate Luffy, controlling him, which that's pretty cool. Kind of surprised he can do that, frankly.
Yeah. So this is one of those things where I don't criticize these things too much, but it's like, all right, you have control of Luffy. Just, you could have ended it right there. Yeah. You could have ended it. You could have defeated Luffy and ended the show, but he kind of plays around a bit. And then Luffy goes into, he plays around for several minutes, and then Luffy goes into like his fourth gear mode and breaks free of the strings and then starts flying. And then I think even Doflamingo even says something kind of like almost low key, like, oh, he broke free. It's like, yeah, you should have did something. You should have done something before you did that.
You had a chance, buddy.
Yeah. But I mean, that's all villains, right? They have to have some,
especially Doflamingo. He's one of the cockiest villains there is. I mean, he cannot believe anyone can beat him.
I mean, if villains always did the most like efficient, you know, most pragmatic, smartest, villainous thing they could do, they would win way more often than they do.
Yeah.
So this is one of those villain flaws. It's like, yeah, I just toyed around too much.
Did you ever read or see the movie The Watchmen?
The original Watchmen or the...
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, the...
I haven't seen the HBO series. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The original movie, though. You know, that like that's a good example of when the bad guy doesn't play his hand and he wins. The bad guy wins. Yep. he was smart. Yep. Okay. Anyway, so we come back. Like you said, we come back from the break and Luffy's transformed into fourth gear. And there's a lot of like a little bit of a flashback with him training with Rayleigh. And he's like, I can't beat somebody with my Kong gun.
Kong punch. Or Kong gun, yeah.
Kong gun is not strong enough. And then Rayleigh's like, well, you're just going to have to come up with an even better move than that. He's like, better than Kong gun?
What would that be?
Well, it's called the King Kong gun. That's what he uses. Real original naming there.
Yeah.
Luffy. By the way,
I mean, this is the guy who calls it second gear, third gear, fourth gear.
But does this mean that King Kong is a thing in the One Piece world? Do they see the movie King Kong?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to go with that. They got transponder snail movie theaters that project King Kong. Anyway, so he uses King Kong gun, and that ultimately defeats Doflamingo. And what I believe, and I don't want to speak for you, but in my opinion, kind of a tepid defeat for Doflamingo.
Even with the beam struggle, which I know is like anime only, it's still just kind of a little bit underwhelming.
I think it's made worse by the fact that like Luffy has like a speech he usually gives right before he defeats an enemy. And he gave that speech really early in the episode. And then there's just a whole lot of him flying around in fourth gear for a long time before he punches. And it's like, oh, okay.
I wonder if this is an anime pacing symptom.
Could be.
Where maybe in the manga he gives a speech. So what I read from the thread is that there is no beam struggle in the manga version. So maybe in the manga version he basically gives a speech, does a punch, and then it's out. Where the anime kind of stretches it out.
I think one thing we can say with certainty is that the events of this episode all took place in the same chapter for sure. So, So it's mostly, you're right. And the beams. Well, somebody even went as far as to say that like this beam, quote unquote, beam struggle, which by the way, for anyone listening, what we mean is that like Doflamingo is shooting his strings, Luffy is punching, and they're meeting in midair and just pushing against each other.
I think beam struggle is basically a carryover from Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah.
Any sort of like power versus power encounter is just called a beam struggle, no matter what it is.
Yeah. So someone in the thread said that like, well, this is obviously an anime invention that didn't happen in the manga. And they say to the point that because it's actually called out later, that there was a beam struggle that happens later in the series that actually is, I don't even think canonically pointed out to be a beam struggle to a certain effect. I don't remember this.
Someone mentioned that like there must be a later struggle that is somehow mentioned that like I'm envisioning off the top of my head. It's like, I've never had a struggle like this before or something like that. Where it's like, oh yes you have. You did it with Horty. You did it with Doflamingo.
Remember Horty? Exactly. You're right. They did do it with Horty too, didn't they? Yeah.
No.
Anyway, Doflamingo is defeated. And we know this because his iconic sunglasses fall to the ground and crack, which is very symbolic. I like that.
And now we head into the part of the arc where the story happens, basically.
Yes. Yeah, we've still got about, and brace yourself, we've got about 30 episodes left until we're technically out of this arc. I think it's 30. Let me look this up.
Yeah. I'm curious.
I want to know for sure because I don't want to like mislead you. One second. What was this episode called?
This episode is Attack on a Celestial, Luffy's King Kong Gun.
Okay. So this is episode 733. And according to this list, 746 is the last of the Dressrosa arc. So how many is that?
13.
13. Okay, I'm sorry. I said 30. Sorry about that. Yeah.
No, that's fine.
I'm glad I checked that because that would have been ridiculous. So 13, I was thinking it was like, oh, it's like a season. So like,
yeah,
but it's really more like a core. So it's really just a core.
I mean, so, it's the whole Blue Exorcist Kyoto saga.
Right. Yeah, that was what I was thinking of, but I don't know why I pulled 30 out of my head. But yeah, 13 episodes left. But like you said, or like we said, it's mostly post-Dressrosa stuff. So I'm sure next episode we have to like spend a whole episode confirming that Doflamingo's defeated. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. We'll spend a whole episode confirming that he's defeated. Then we'll spend another whole episode that the birdcage is stopped.
Right. But we're into the post-Dressrosa sort of stuff. Like, we gotta deal with the situation that we are left in. And we've got, then we'll get some of this other stuff as well. Not very long from now, we'll start to get some of the, like, what's happening elsewhere in the One Piece world, that kind of stuff.
I always like that kind of stuff, though.
Oh, me too. I'm looking forward to it. I know something really cool that happens. All right. So overall, I mean, I don't think this was an amazing episode of One Piece. I'm just glad that that Doflamingo is defeated. And yeah. So we can finally move on from that. I can't believe it. We are actually close to being done with Dressrosa.
Yeah.
Over 100 episodes. Okay, well, I don't know if we have any flavor alerts.
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
Well, I mean, like, I'm thinking, like, Dragon Ball Daima voice actors don't want to do that after one episode. I know you said you liked the king guy, or the, mm-hmm. what's his name?
Goma.
Degasu and Goma. Like, let's see what happens. It's too early to do it in one episode. I'm sure there's going to be some Bleach names that will add to the name list or powers. Well,
what was the guy's name? Was it said the na-na-na guy?
No, I don't think he was in this episode.
Okay. Well, when we get to that guy, it's a nomination immediately. I'm sorry, I laughed so hard.
Yes.
Na-na-na-na-na-na-kachu or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking through my stuff here. Just making sure.
Like the Lazarus episode was neat, but I don't know if there's any like individual moment that was best.
That's the problem I have with Lazarus, is that it's never about a moment. It's just like overall the show is good, but there's never like a standout moment that makes me go, wow.
So, yeah, it's pretty consistent.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to go. I mean, we can't obviously nominate Dragon Ball Daima for production values. Again, it's too soon, but also we don't do that anyway. It's always everything. So, but that's going to be a contender, I think, if it continues with this level of quality, for me at least.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Blue Exorcist didn't have much of anything super amazing in this episode. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I can't think of any. Maybe we'll just have to pass this week.
Yeah, we don't have any this week, so we're good. We'll move on. All right, so that is it for episode 430. Thank you for being here, Seda.
Yep, no problem.
All right, and we will see you guys next week for the same lineup for episode 431. And until then, later.